danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome. I'm Andrew Brokus. You're going to hear me say that again in just a moment, but I've got some breaking news, which is that I'm going to be offering a pretty substantial discount on the already most affordable form of coaching that I do, which is custom videos. Those are going to be 25% off if you purchase two or more hours before the end of December 2018. So what these are is you can send me a database of hands that you've played online. You can send me an online hand history from a tournament or a cash game session. You can just email me some questions or stuff, either hands or just strategy questions. I've had people just commission. And they wanted to hear me talk about particular things. And in fact, this episode of the podcast you're about to listen to is an example of what something like that could sound like. So you can commission something like this that I would record for you. It would be audio and or video. And those are usually $100 per hour. But if you purchase two or more hours before the end of December 2018, you're going to get a 25% discount, which means that you'd be getting 2 hours for $150. If you're interested in that, you can email me, andrew@thinkingpoker.net. You can leave a comment here on the blog. You can tweet at me, @thinkingpoker, anything to get my attention. Let me know if you're interested or if you have questions. Thanks. Enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to episode 278 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From a relatively remote part of northern New Mexico, I'm Andrew Brokus. This is going to be a solo episode and a kind of a special episode, if you want to think of it that way, a slightly different format. It's going to be sort of a spoken essay, a monologue, I guess those are called, where I'm going to talk about... Well, I'm going to give kind of an introduction to what I think are some important game theoretic concepts, but with a focus on common misunderstandings. I think we're at a point in poker now where a lot of people have heard terms like indifference, mixed strategy, exploitable, game theoretically optimal, right? These terms float through the poker world. I think that a relatively small number of people really understand them and use them correctly, either in conversation or when they're actually playing poker. I think it's sometimes a case of a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. I think more commonly people disregard potentially valuable information that they could glean from even a little bit of studying of game theory. So when I say studying game theory, I don't necessarily mean buying a solver and teaching yourself how to use it and spending dozens of hours analyzing solutions to various situations. I just mean understanding some of the basic concepts like I talked about and knowing how to and when to apply those concepts when you're actually playing. And just a quick heads up for those of you who might be inclined to shut this off now, one of the myths that I intend to address is the myth that game theory is only relevant if you are playing against very talented opponents or if you are playing against opponents that you expect to encounter again and again or expect to have a lot of history with. I think both of those things are very wrong. So if your finger is hovering over the stop and delete button, I don't think there's a stop and delete button. If it's hesitating over the stop button with the intention of moving along to the delete button, let me just stop you there. If your reason is that you think this is not going to be applicable to you, in fact, I think it's probably most applicable to you because those are some of the myths that I intend to dismiss. Before we get too deep into it, I do want to remind you that if you want more strategy, including some more advanced game theory stuff that I and some other instructors at Tournament Poker Edge have put together, Matt Hunt is another one who's particularly good on this concept, check out Tournament Poker Edge. You'll find lots of videos, some of which are about game theory, many of which don't address it explicitly, from myself and lots of other instructors at Tournament Poker Edge. Something like 10 years worth of archives of videos now available there, new videos getting added almost every day, plus forums, more strategy podcasts now hosted by many time Thinking Poker guest Clayton Fletcher, all of that available at tournamentpokeredge.com. Couple other things I want to let you know about. With the holidays coming, maybe you're planning on doing some shopping for other folks or perhaps even for yourself. You could use the Thinking Poker affiliate link. Wouldn't cost you anything. Would make a little bit of money for Nate and myself. The way to do that is to head to thinkingpoker.net and click on the Support the Podcast tab, and there you'll find affiliate links for Amazon.com, Amazon.uk, Amazon.ca. A pretty good chance if you're in one of the larger countries that Amazon serves, then there's a pretty good chance that we have an affiliate link for you. Certainly appreciate it if you check that out. Also, if you're shopping for holiday gifts, or again, just for yourself, check out nickcast.com, and that's where you'll find books and premium podcasts that Nate and I have created, in some cases together, in some cases individually. Last but not least, I do have that year-end fundraiser for the Bay Area Urban Debate League running. A lot of you probably know about this because you heard about it on last week's episode, or maybe if you are really kind people, you were donors in past years. This is an organization and a cause that's really important to me. I feel like competitive debate did a lot to make me the person that I am, and if you find that you get value out of listening to me speak, that's a skill that was cultivated in high school and college competitive debate. While I was in college, and even more so since graduating, I've done a lot of work with urban debate leagues around the country. In Chicago, I actually founded a league in Boston. I'm currently on the board of an organization in the Bay Area called the Bay Area Urban Debate League. And these are organizations that start and run similar programs in urban public high schools. These are schools where there are often not a lot of academic outlets for kids who are academically inclined, which is one of the advantages of these programs. The other advantage is sometimes the kids who get the most out of debate are kids who never thought of themselves as academically inclined. And I probably checked both of these boxes when I was in high school. Right? You get a lot of kids who are precocious in some ways, but maybe don't deal well with authority or don't like being told what they're supposed to study or learn. And debate is very much a kind of student-centered. There's a lot of freedom for students to explore the arguments that they're interested in, or how they want to make arguments in the ways that are interesting to them. It's just it's an activity that gives students a lot of intellectual freedom. And you do sometimes get students who were doing very poorly in a traditional classroom environment. And we've certainly had kids who were on the verge of dropping out. In fact, you can hear Josh Nixon, who is a former one of my students in the Boston Debate League, talk about that on this very podcast when he was a guest on the show. Yeah, so it does sometimes appeal to kids who are on a bad track or a track that's not so likely to lead to success, and debate sometimes can turn around the trajectory of those students. I think it also is useful to kids who are, you know, pretty clever, are probably going to be okay, are probably going to go to some sort of university, but debate helps them to get into a, you know, better school than they would have. It just kind of sets them on a higher academic trajectory. You know, my theory has always been, and this has certainly been borne out in my experience, that there are really smart people born everywhere. And I mean, yeah, there's plenty of not smart people too. I don't want to tell you that like every single kid that I ever worked with in this program was exceptional, but I worked with a lot of exceptional students, and it's really a shame how much talent ends up going to waste, because we've just got very talented people, people with a lot of innate talent who are born into circumstances that result in that talent just never being cultivated. These Urban Debate Leagues, I think, are a really good program for sort of finding and cultivating those diamonds in the rough. That's one of the ways that I think about the value of my involvement with these programs. And I am deeply involved with the Bay Area Urban Debate League as a volunteer, as a donor myself, and as a member of their board. If you're interested in supporting me, us, them, the work that we do, as little as $5 would get you access to the sort of incentive that I'm doing this year, which is that every person who donates $5 or more gets to ask a question to Nate or to me. Maybe I'll even try to rip Carlos into this. That hasn't been decided yet. You can ask about poker. If you really want to ask about something other than poker, that's fine too. We'll do our best with it. And then we're going to record some special podcast episodes that are just consisting only of our answers to your questions. So this is a way to get a more or less guaranteed answer. I mean, I guess there's some stuff I'd probably take off the table, but a more or less guaranteed answer to your questions. I know some people are frustrated. They write to the podcast and we don't ever put their show on the air. So this is a chance to have us talk about your questions. And everyone who makes a donation of $5 or more will get all of those podcasts. So you'll get the answer not just to your question, but to every question that everyone asked. Certainly, donations larger than $5 are very welcome, but $5 is all it takes to qualify for that. To make your contribution, you can head to thinkingpoker.net, and the first or second post, you know, basically the only thing on thinkingpoker.net these days is the podcast posts. So there's going to be a link in the show notes for, you know, basically every podcast between now and the end of 2018, and you'll be able to find links in there. That's probably the easiest place to find them. Also, if you follow me at Thinking Poker on Twitter, you'll be able to find them there. Thanks very much for considering that and listening to all that preamble stuff. Let's get down to business. So our goal here, I want to do a little primer on game theory, explain some of the basic concepts, tell you why I think it's worth understanding, even if you're a small stakes player, even if you're playing with people that you don't play with on a regular basis or anything like that. And in particular, I want to address some of the common misconceptions about game theory. So first off, what is game theory? The Oxford dictionaries define it as, quote, the branch of mathematics concerned with the analysis of strategies for dealing with competitive situations where the outcome of a participant's choice of action depends critically on the actions of other participants. So that's kind of complicated. The really important part to pay attention to is that the outcome of your action, what your action ends up being worth, depends on the actions of other players. This distinguishes poker from something like, say, bowling obviously could be done competitively against other people, but if you're just kind of bowling to set your own personal best, nothing that anyone else does really influences your outcome in that game. Right? You might make EV decisions at some point about, you know, which pins you're going to try to knock down or something like that. Do you try to go for the strike that's going to have a higher payoff but a lower chance of success, or do you take a more conservative strategy? I mean, there are choices like that that you might make as a bowler, but your choices are not influenced by anyone else in the game. The outcome of your choices are entirely based on your strategy and your role. In poker, that's not the case. In poker, for instance, if we want to think about the EV of bluffing on the river, the expected value of bluffing the river, we don't know that in a vacuum. We can't just say, what is it worth to bluff the river? Right? I mean, that depends on what the opponent does. If the opponent is going to fold, or he's going to fold a certain percentage of the time, then that's going to tell us what the expected value of bluffing is. If he's planning on folding, then it's going to have a high expected value. If he's planning on calling, then it's going to have a very poor expected value. And you are not able to determine that unilaterally. It's not entirely up to you. And that's a thing that I think a lot of people have trouble grasping in poker. People have trouble accepting that they're not entirely in control of their outcomes. And they always think, well, if I just made the perfect bet size, I could force my opponent to do exactly what I wanted him to do. And that's great if you can actually cause it to happen. I mean, sometimes you'll have a really good read on somebody and you can just be certain that he's going to call if you make a certain bet size, or he's going to fold if you make a certain bet size. That's great, but it's not the norm. It's not typically the situation that you're in poker. Normally, we have to make decisions in poker about whether to, for instance, bluff the river when we don't know what the other player is going to do. And it's not just a matter of, like, if we analyzed all the information we had, we could eventually figure out what he's going to do. Like, we just don't have enough information to determine what is this player going to do on the river. And this really is what poker is all about. It's about making decisions under conditions of uncertainty. Like, poker is not about sure things. It's not about, right? I mean, even when you have strong hands, they're not usually a sure thing to win. But likewise, any particular play that you make, you know, when you value bet, it's not a sure thing you're going to get paid off. When you bluff, it's not a sure thing your opponent's going to fold. It's not about being sure. Game theory is a useful tool when you are not in a position to guess at what your opponent's strategy is going to be or at what your opponent's going to do. Game theory helps you to formulate a strategy of your own that will be resilient to any strategy that your opponent might employ. So in that example about bluffing the river, one approach would be just to try to guess whether your opponent is going to fold. If you guess right, then congratulations, you exploited him. If you guess wrong, and whoops, he just exploited you. So the game theory approach is, instead of guessing, to try to find a betting strategy that makes your opponent indifferent to calling. In other words, you can't force him to fold or call. You don't necessarily know whether he's going to fold or call, but you can try to put him in a spot where there is no right play for him, where folding or calling will end up having the same expected value against your betting range. That way, there's no way for him to outplay you. Now, there's going to be a correct play given your actual hand, right? Like in any particular situation, you're either bluffing or you aren't. But if you think about it in terms of betting a range of hands in this situation, you can potentially find a betting range such that your opponent makes about the same amount of money whether he calls or folds. And we'll talk about the advantages and disadvantages of that, but it's an option that's on the table, and it's often the best option if you don't know what your opponent's going to do and you don't really have any information for guessing. I would argue that the use of the term optimal in this sense, right, we say the game theoretically optimal strategy. Optimal there is being used in the normal sense of the word optimal, like the best thing to do if you don't know what your opponent's choice is going to be is to try to create a situation where there is no correct choice for your opponent. It's true that one case where this tool is useful is when your opponent is very talented, or at least more talented than you are. In that case, it can be dicey to try to predict what he's going to do, because sort of by definition, he's going to be better at playing that game than you are, right? He's going to be better at guessing and exploiting your strategy than you're going to be at exploiting his. So trying to find a strategy that this opponent can exploit is probably the best that you're going to do. A lot of people, I think, assume that that's the only case where game theory is relevant. You've probably heard this, or maybe even thought it, that game theory only matters if your opponents are really good. I would say that's a half-truth. It's true that you're better off trying to guess your opponent's strategy, even if you can't be sure about it, when you have some kind of information to go on. If you have reason to think that you can play that guessing game better than your opponent can, right? That you can better guess, here's what he's going to do, like, I think he's going to fold too much, therefore I'm going to bluff too much, right? That's a game that you're engaging in. You're trying to guess what he's going to do, and if you're right, great, but if you're wrong, and it turns out he expects you to bluff too much, and therefore he calls too much, well, then he's outplayed you in that game. So it's a choice that you can make whether or not you want to engage in that game. If you have some kind of hunch to go on, it doesn't have to be a sure thing. Again, we're not talking about sure things. If you have some kind of hunch to go on, then you very well might be better off trying to engage in that game. So I'm not saying that you should always try to play unexploitably. You won't always be right, but you'll probably do better on average making an educated guess than just trying to do something unexploitable. Sometimes, though, even if you know that a particular player is weak, you might not know exactly how to exploit him in a given situation. Maybe you know that he calls too much on the river, but that doesn't necessarily tell you what you should do with an overpair if he check raises you on the flop. Game theory is useful anytime you aren't sure what the best play is, and even poor players can put you in those situations sometimes. Yeah, better players are more likely to be putting you in situations where you're not sure what the best play is, but it comes up against weaker players as well. Just because someone is weak doesn't necessarily mean that you have all the insight into how to exploit them in every possible situation. And I'm sure you've had this experience where you say, oh God, I know this guy's terrible at poker, but you know, he just check raised me on the turn and I have no idea what I should do with bottom two pair or whatever, you know, like whatever it is. Like we've all been in those kinds of situations and game theory can help you in those spots. Any of those spots where you find yourself struggling and saying, boy, I really don't know what the right play is. That's where game theory is useful. Probably most importantly, though, game theory can actually help you to make better exploitive plays. Sometimes it's obvious what you should be doing to exploit a particular opponent's mistake. If you know that your opponent's going to call too much on the river, then you don't bluff the river. That's pretty straightforward. But there's lots of situations where you might not even realize that your opponent is making a mistake if you don't know what an unexploitable strategy would look like in the first place. I can say from personal experience that studying game theory has helped me to identify mistakes and also opportunities for exploitive plays, even against some of the weaker people that I play against, that I didn't used to find. Because I have a better sense of what an equilibrium strategy would look like in a lot of different situations, I'm better equipped to look and say, hey, I bet that guy's not check-raising the turn as much as he's supposed to be. I bet he's not three-betting a flop check-raise as much as he's supposed to be. That kind of stuff didn't used to cross my mind as much as it does since I've been studying game theory. The next concept that I want to talk about is equilibrium. An equilibrium arises when two players are using unexploitable strategies. And the definition of an equilibrium, and I'm not going to do it as formally as I did with game theory, but the definition of an equilibrium is that neither player can improve his expected value by unilaterally changing his strategy. In other words, if you and I are both playing equilibrium strategies, then we're each going to have a certain expected value. I mean, it's going to change depending on what hand we have, but when I say strategy, I mean how we're going to play every single hand we could possibly have in this particular situation. And this is what a solver like Pio Solver does, is you put in all the possible hands, and then it spits out unexploitable strategies for both players. So if we're both playing an unexploitable strategy, we're each going to have a certain expected value. And one player might have a higher expected value based on having, for instance, position or a stronger starting range or something else that doesn't have anything to do with skill, that's more like a structural feature of the situation. But there's not going to be an advantage based on skill in this game because we're both playing unexploitably, so no one has a skill advantage on someone else. The definition of equilibrium says that if I were to change my strategy and yours stayed the same, I would not be able to increase my expected value. Depending on what changes I made to my strategy, I might continue to have the same expected value as if I were playing an equilibrium strategy, or I might actually end up with a lower expected value, but it wouldn't be possible for me to do better. Now, if both of us changed our strategies, if we both deviated from the equilibrium strategies in some way, then it would be possible for me to improve my EV. But if you keep playing your equilibrium, then there's nothing that I can do to produce a higher EV than what my equilibrium strategy would give me. So basically, when we're at equilibrium, neither of us has any incentive to change. Let me give you a simple example of that. Let's say that I owe you $100, and I'm trying to avoid you because I don't want to pay you your $100. Maybe some of you have been in this situation before on one or both ends of this transaction. Meanwhile, you're trying to find me so that you can collect your $100. Okay, it's Saturday night, we're both going to go play poker, and there's two different poker rooms that we could go to. But just for the sake of this example, we'll use Baltimore area poker rooms. So we're either going to go to Maryland Live or we're going to go to the Horseshoe. And just to keep things simple, let's say that each of us is going to choose exactly one poker room and just go there and stay there. So you can't go to Live and then look and see if I'm not at Live, then you go look for me at Horseshoe. Just take that off the table. We're each going to choose one poker room and go and play there. If we end up at the same room, then you're going to collect your $100 from me. If we go to different rooms, then I keep the $100, right? So this is the game. You're trying to go to the same poker room that I'm going to go to, and I'm trying to go to a different poker room than what you go to. And let's also ignore any other reasons for choosing one poker room over another, okay? There's no bad beat jackpots, there's no traffic, there's no, you know, better food at one place or another. Each of us is just making a choice solely based on this debt. I'm trying to avoid the debt, or I'm trying to avoid paying back the debt, you're trying to collect on the debt. Okay, what's your strategy? How do you decide which poker room you're going to go to if you want to maximize your chances of showing up at the same room that I go to and collecting this debt? The exploitive approach here would be to try to guess which poker room I'm going to go to. Right? Maybe you think that I like the horseshoe better, so you're going to go to the horseshoe and try to find me there. Again, that's great if you actually have a good reason to think that you can play that guessing game better than I can. But, you know, maybe I know that you're going to expect me to go to the horseshoe. So then I can exploit you by going to live. Right? If you play what's called a pure strategy, meaning that you just pick one room and you go there, like 100% probability you decide you're going to go to the horseshoe, that's always going to be exploitable. We're never going to have an equilibrium if you're predictably always going to the same poker room. Because it's always there's always going to be a correct counter strategy for me. You can gamble on whether or not I'll actually find that counter strategy, but the counter strategy does exist. If I knew that your strategy were always go to horseshoe, then I could unilaterally change my strategy and always go to Maryland Live and increase my expected value. So that's any strategy that involves you going to horseshoe is not going to be in equilibrium. Or sorry, any strategy that involves you always going to the same poker room is not going to be in equilibrium. If you always go to horseshoe, then I exploit by always going to Maryland Live. But then you can improve your EV in that situation by going to Maryland Live to collect the debt from me. So now we're both going to Maryland Live, but then I can improve my EV by going to the horseshoe. Now we're in different rooms again. You can improve your EV by going to the horseshoe. We're never going to reach an equilibrium this way. It's always going to be possible for one of us to improve his EV if one or both of us is playing a pure strategy, always just going to one room with 100% frequency. If you want to be unexploitable, you have to use what's called a mixed strategy. It has to be random and unpredictable. There has to be some chance that you're going to end up at either poker room. In fact, in this particular situation, there has to be an equal chance that you'll end up at either room. So if your strategy is flip a coin, if it's heads, go to horseshoe, if it's Maryland Live, or if it's tails, go to Maryland Live, I can't exploit that strategy. No matter what my strategy is, whether I go to horseshoe with 100% frequency, I go to live with 100% frequency, or if I flip a coin myself, there's always going to be a 50% chance that you catch me and make me pay up. Right? That gets rid of my incentive to change my strategy. For it to be in equilibrium, though, right? So in other words, if you're flipping a coin, then whatever my strategy is, I'm not going to have any incentive to change it. I can't do any better than 50% no matter what I choose. So I have no incentive to change my strategy. Now, for us to be in equilibrium, it has to be the case that neither of us has any incentive to change strategies. So I would also have to do the same thing that you're doing. I would also have to be flipping a coin to choose which poker room I'm going to go to. And then if both of us are flipping a coin or otherwise choosing randomly which poker room we're going to go to, with exactly a 50% chance of choosing either room, then that's an equilibrium. So even if each of us knew what the other person's strategy was, like I knew that you're flipping a coin, you know that I'm flipping a coin, we still couldn't improve our EV by changing our own strategies. And again, that wouldn't be the case if your strategy, for instance, were always, you know, to go to horseshoe with 100% frequency. Because if I knew that that were your strategy, then I could exploit it by always going to Maryland Live. One of the features of equilibrium is you could literally tell your opponent, here is my strategy, I'll write it down for you. Here's how I'm going to play every single hand I could possibly have in this situation. And still, there would be nothing that your opponent could do to exploit that information. There would be a best way to play against it, but there would be a limit to just how successful that could be. I think the thing that confuses and intimidates people the most about game theory is mixed strategies. If you've ever looked at, you know, say a Pio Solver solution to a flop situation, what you see is this really complicated looking grid that's telling you, well, when you have ace king, bet 87%, when you have ace queen, bet 62.6%, etc. And it's easy to look at that and think, well, maybe a supercomputer can do this, but I sure can't. You know, I can't just, you know, implement, A, I can't memorize all these different frequencies, and B, even if I could, I wouldn't be capable of implementing this kind of really complicated mixed strategy when I'm actually playing. So, you know, what the hell am I supposed to do with this thing? I think that's a pretty common reaction to looking at these solutions. The most important thing to understand about mixed strategies is that they occur only when you're indifferent between two options at equilibrium. In other words, if checking and betting have the same equilibrium EV, then you probably end up mixing between those two, right? Probably it's you're going to sometimes check and sometimes bet. And this is what we see in that example about me owing you this $100 debt, right? If your strategy is to flip a coin, then whether I go to Horseshoe or I go to Live, my EV is the same. Right? There's a 50% chance that I have to pay you $100, which means I have an EV of negative $50, right? 50.5 times 100 or times negative 100. So I have an EV of negative $50 no matter what I choose. And because the EV is the same, whether I go to Live or I go to Horseshoe, then I can play a mixed strategy. If we change that up even just a little bit, so you know somehow you're going to Horseshoe 51% of the time and you're going to Live 49% of the time, then I'm not indifferent anymore. There is a best strategy for me. Right? The best strategy is I should just always go to Maryland Live. I don't improve my EV by much. I'm not doing much better than negative $50, but now my EV is only negative $49. There's only a 49% chance that you're going to find me. So I am improving my EV. I now have a 51% chance of dodging that debt to you. And so there's no reason why I should ever go to Horseshoe. As long as you keep playing that same strategy, I'm not going to have a mixed strategy of my own. I'm just always going to do better by going to Maryland Live. There'd be no reason for me to change it up unless I thought that you were going to be allowed to change your strategy. But if we keep your strategy fixed and we say you're always going to Horseshoe 51% of the time and Maryland Live 49% of the time, then I'm not indifferent. There's just a strictly better option for me. Mixed strategies are extremely sensitive to small changes like this, right? I'm only indifferent if you get your frequencies exactly right and vice versa. If you change just a tiny little bit like we saw, then suddenly I'm going to have a preference for one option over another. So in practice, if you look at a solver solution and that tells you that you're indifferent between betting or checking with a certain hand, that doesn't mean that you actually should be randomizing your decision and doing those things at the frequency that the solver tells you. Or even if you had the very slightest hint that your opponent, for instance, is going to fold a little bit too much if you bet, well, then bluffing in that situation is going to be strictly better than checking. Even though at equilibrium you're indifferent, it takes very, very little to make the correct play for you one thing or the other. So these are the situations where it's best to guess. Is these situations where you believe that you would be indifferent at equilibrium or where a solver tells you you're indifferent at equilibrium. Those are the situations where it makes the most sense for you to play the guessing game and to say, I'm just going to try to guess what my opponent's going to do. Because even if I get it wrong, the consequences aren't really that high. Like at equilibrium, I'm literally indifferent. So it might actually not matter. But if my opponent is doing something exploitable, I think I can guess which way he's going. But not all hands are indifferent in equilibrium. Right? Some hands are better for bluffing than others. Typically, if you look at like a river situation in PioSolver, you'll see that some hands are plus EV bluffs. These usually involve having blockers of some kind. Some hands are negative EV bluffs. These might be hands that have reverse blockers, meaning that they're like blocking some of your opponent's folding range, or it might just be that they have enough showdown value to the point where checking and trying to win is better than bluffing. So you've got hands that are plus EV bluffs, you've got hands that are negative EV bluffs, and then you have some hands that are indifferent between bluffing and checking. And it doesn't take much of a read at all to justify doing something exploitive when you're indifferent. But when you've got a hand that would be a plus EV bluff at equilibrium, right, maybe there's three hearts on the board and you've got the ace of hearts in your hand, then it's possible that bluffing could be correct for you even if your opponent is a little bit of a calling station. Your hand is so good for bluffing that you might make money with it even against a strategy that's a little bit too loose. And likewise, there are some hands that might be more profitable as checks even if your opponent folds a little bit too much. So just because you've decided that you're going to guess and try to exploit an opponent in some situations doesn't mean that you should do it with every candidate hand in that situation. Like every hand that you could possibly consider bluffing with on the river, you shouldn't necessarily bluff with every single one of those just because you have an inkling that your opponent's going to fold a little bit too often. There are certain hands that even in equilibrium, those would be plus EV bluffs. You should definitely bluff with those. And there's some hands where you think, oh, I'm probably more or less indifferent with this hand at equilibrium. Okay, then you should probably just always bluff with those also. And then the hands that you wouldn't want to bluff with are the ones that are like negative EV at equilibrium, that are particularly poor bluffing hands. That's some of the low-hanging fruit that the game theory can help you to capture. And I think it's one of the best things that I've learned from studying game theory, which is how to predict which hands go in which of those categories. Like, what are the plus EV bluffs? What are the negative EV bluffs? And you learn to recognize what makes a hand particularly good or particularly bad for bluffing, particularly good or bad for slow playing, particularly good or bad for check raising the flop. You get an idea of how much bluffing or check raising you should be doing in a given situation. And then that helps you to recognize when an opponent is likely doing too much or too little and how you should go about exploiting that. So let me move on to addressing what I think. I mean, I've addressed some of these obliquely already, but let me be a little more explicit about addressing what I think are some of the common misunderstandings. So one is the idea that being balanced or being unpredictable means just being capable of showing up with any hand at any time. There's this idea that that's what it means. To be tricky, you just have to be like totally unpredictable, or you have to be randomizing everything you do at every decision point. That's kind of absurd if you just think it through a little bit. Like, there are many instances where pure strategies, meaning playing the same hand the same way 100% of the time, are optimal. Even at equilibrium, you're going to find plenty of situations where pure strategies are optimal. For instance, you're holding a weak hand on the river and you're facing a large bet. Or really holding a weak hand on any street, facing a large bet. The optimal play is probably just to fold every time. You don't need to, call the flop. You don't need to call a pocket twos occasionally when the flop is ace, king, queen, just to be tricky and mix it up. Right? That's probably just a losing play against almost anyone. And whatever value you get from being tricky is, there's some value there. Like, if the turn is a deuce, maybe your opponent wouldn't think that you called with a two, and you might have really good implied odds if you hit that deuce. However, it just doesn't happen often enough to make up for how much money you're losing when you make that call the vast majority of the time. So, there's plenty of cases like that where even if there is some value to being unpredictable, it's not worth the price that you have to pay for it. So the only time that you want to be mixing your strategies, as we discussed, is when you think two options are equally good, and even in that case, it is not always important that you do some of both. Like, sometimes it's still going to be better for you to just pick one option, but that's the time when it might make sense for you to randomize. It's definitely not true that you want to just be randomizing in every possible situation, or that should just always be possible for you to show up with any hand. I don't know how many people believe that anymore, but that's a thing you used to hear a lot, is like, oh, he's a really tough player to play against. He could just show up with anything at any time. That doesn't sound like a tough player to me. That sounds like a huge fish. One of the more common misunderstandings, I think, is that game theory is a strategy that's designed to break even, but not to win. And this is a tricky one, and it's not even entirely false, but it is false. So it's true that equilibrium strategies are conservative, which is to say that they protect you from being exploited rather than attempting to exploit actively mistakes that your opponents might make. If both you and your opponents were to play equilibrium strategies, then neither of you would have any advantage over the other, at least not based on skill. As we said, something like position could make the game plus EV. But in fact, game theory can help you to ensure that you reap the rewards of a structural advantage like position, even if you're playing against an opponent with superior skill. But if your opponent deviates more than slightly from his equilibrium strategy, then it is, in fact, possible for your equilibrium strategy to profit from that deviation, even though you aren't actively doing anything to exploit it. You probably won't benefit as much as you would from a strategy that was explicitly crafted to exploit your opponent's mistake, but you will benefit. And this is really useful in cases where you expect that your opponent will make mistakes, but you aren't sure what those mistakes are going to be. So for instance, if your opponent is bluffing way too much, right, he's even bluffing with hands that are negative EV bluffs at equilibrium, like they're hands that he'd be much better off just checking those hands, but he's bluffing with them anyway, then even if you're playing like an unexploitable or equilibrium strategy, you're still going to profit from those bluffs, right? Because they're negative EV at equilibrium. They're money-losing bluffs, even against your equilibrium strategy. That's what that means, to say it's negative EV at equilibrium. So he's losing money by bluffing with these really poor candidates. And it would be true if you figured out that he was bluffing way too much and you changed your own strategy to exploit that. You started calling with a bunch of bluff catchers that you usually fold. You would be making a lot more money against that player. But even your equilibrium strategy is going to profit from it. So I think sometimes people have the idea of like, well, I don't want to play to just break even. Like, there's a rake. So if I just play to break even, then I'm guaranteed to lose. Like, I have to be trying to exploit my opponents at all times. And that's not true. There are plenty of cases where if your opponents are making small to medium, certainly large fundamental mistakes, you can profit from those even if you're not actively doing anything to exploit those mistakes. Like, an opponent who raises 7 deuce offsuit under the gun. You've never played with this player before. You have no idea who he is. Suddenly he enters a pot. He's raising 7 deuce offsuit under the gun. You don't have to know that he's doing that. If you just have sort of a you know, reasonable strategy for responding to an under the gun raise, you're going to make money just because 7-2 offsuit is like in such poor shape against the range of hands that you're going to play against an under the gun raise. And, you know, whatever chance he has of stealing the blinds isn't enough to justify playing such a poor hand out of position. And once you figure out that he's raising, you know, every single hand that he's dealt under the gun, there's plenty of things you can do to make even more money. But whatever is your like default strategy for responding to an under the gun raise is going to profit from the fact that your opponent is raising with this terrible hand that he shouldn't be raising with. Another common misunderstanding is that being balanced or being unexploitable only matters when you're going to play lots of hands against a particular opponent. You're going to play against them for a long time, or maybe over the course of many sessions or something like that. So people have the idea, and this actually came up in last week's strategy episode, people have the idea, you know, maybe you're playing on Bovada and the tables are anonymous and people aren't going to have reads on you, or you're playing Zoom poker and you get moved every hand, you're never going to play with these players, you're only going to play at most a couple hundred hands with somebody, so you know, what does it matter whether you're balanced, right? I think the idea is that you can just go ahead and employ an exploitive strategy. You don't have to worry about your opponent realizing what you're doing and adapting to it. Okay, so I agree completely with that. In fact, I think you should even employ exploitive strategies against irregular opponents when you can. You just have to be alert to signs that they might be adapting. The trouble is you're not always going to have an exploitive strategy available to you. Right? This is particularly true when your opponent is not someone that you play regularly. You may be able to predict some exploits. Like you might just say, I think the average poker player, or the average 1-2 player or whatever calls too much on the river. And so I'm going to assume that this player, until I have evidence otherwise, I'm going to assume that this player also calls too much on the river and I'm going to play appropriately. I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. That's how I play. If I'm playing with someone I've never played with before, I'm going to make some assumptions based on how that person looks and things I hear them say, use some stereotyping. You're always open to more information and you want to revise your read as you get more information about a player. But I think we all probably have an idea of what different types of people, how we might assume different people are going to play just based on how they look. And those are far from 100% accurate, but they're usually better than if we just guessed randomly or just assumed that someone was playing really well. But in cases where you're not able to do something like that, you're not able to guess at what a good exploitive strategy would look like, then a balanced strategy is probably going to be better than just guessing wildly, particularly if this opponent seems good. So if you get seated at a table with Phil Ivey, you might say, well, what do I care about being balanced? I'm never going to play against Phil Ivey again. And you know, hopefully that's true for your bankroll's sake. But the reason you should care about being balanced is in this moment, Phil Ivey is, if you do have imbalances in your game, there's a pretty good chance Phil Ivey is going to be able to guess what they are, even if he doesn't have history with you, and take advantage of them. So you should probably strive to just iron out those exploits from your game as much as you possibly can if you think there's a chance that you're going to run into Phil Ivey. The bottom line is your play is probably just not as original as you think it is. A lot of people are like, well, he's never played with me before. He doesn't know how I play. Yeah, he probably does. Like, you probably play pretty similarly to how a lot of other people play. Like, I've coached a lot of poker players, and most people make a lot of the same mistakes and have a lot of the same misunderstandings. Like, these things don't come from nowhere. Sometimes it's because people have read or misread the same books. Sometimes it's just because there's psychology involved. Human psychology is involved, and there's certain things that people, a lot of people tend to be a little too risk averse, don't like to lose large pots. There's stuff like that that people just have in common. And experienced players know what those things are, and they know how to guess what your imbalances are likely to be, even if they don't have any history with you. Even if it's the first time they've ever played with you, there's a good chance that they're going to be able to size you up in exactly the way I was just describing and say, here's what that player is likely to do wrong. I'm going to try to take advantage of it. And I'm not saying that you should try to guess what they're guessing about you and get one step ahead of them. I mean, it's great if you can do that. I'm just saying that's a reason why you should strive to be balanced. Because if you are imbalanced, a skilled opponent is not going to need a lot of experience with you specifically to guess at what your imbalances are going to be and start exploiting them. In fact, even an unskilled opponent might kind of accidentally blunder into a playing style that actually exploits you very well. For instance, if you decide, and this is a thing I hear people say all the time, I'm not going to bluff until I know that this is a player who can fold, right? My default strategy is going to be never bluff. And then maybe once I've built up a tight image or once I've determined that this is a player who's capable of folding, then I'll start bluffing. But until I have experience with a player, I'm never going to bluff him. it might turn out that, in fact, this person you're playing against is a player who is planning to fold way too often, whose tendency is to fold way too often on the river. And so every time you pass up what would have been a profitable bluffing opportunity, that player is exploiting you. Even though neither of you realizes it. Like, you might not realize that he would have folded if you had bet the river. He might not realize that you should have bluffed the river with the hand that you had, but he's winning pots that he shouldn't have been winning. He's winning pots that you should have been winning if you were playing even an equilibrium strategy, let alone a strategy that was going to exploit his overfolding. And it's not based on him deliberately doing anything to exploit you. It's just that you made an assumption about how he was going to play. He actually plays the exact opposite of that. And the end result is you're getting exploited. With all those pots that you don't win, you're getting exploited. A related misunderstanding is the idea that balance only matters if your opponents know that you're balanced. In fact, just the opposite is true. Like, balance is at its best when your opponents expect you to be unbalanced and they try to exploit you. In poker, you only make money when your opponents make mistakes, and your opponents are more likely to make mistakes if they don't know what your strategy is. The thing that what I have in mind here is the misunderstanding. Sometimes people think that they should show an opponent a bluff so that they'll get paid off later when they're value betting. And there might be exploitive reasons to do this. Like, you might think that anchoring, for instance, if you've read Thinking Fast and Slow, or anchoring is something people see a one big bluff and then they have difficulty revising their strategy later. So if you just show one big bluff and then never bluff again, maybe people just get sort of irrationally locked onto the idea that you're a bluffer. Okay, so that's like an exploitive strategy. That's perfectly fine if you think that's a good thing to do. You find that works, great, keep doing it. But it is an exploitive thing. Like, someone could just as easily say, hey, that guy showed a big bluff. I bet he's doing that to build an image, and he's probably never going to bluff again. And that person who correctly guesses what you're up to can exploit you. So you are going down an exploitive road if you choose to do something like that. I think the frustration that people have is they feel like, oh, my big hands aren't getting paid off because my opponents know that I don't bluff very much, so I need to show them a bluff so that they'll start paying off my big hands. I think that's getting it backwards. I think if you believe that your opponents are folding too often to your bets, that's a good thing for you. That's an opportunity. What you ought to do, rather than trying to help them fix their mistake by showing them how they could be exploited, is shut up and exploit them. Like, start betting in these situations when you have bad hands and you're like, oh, my value bets never get paid in this situation. Okay, great. Then it's a lot easier to have a weak hand in poker. We all know that, right? It's a lot easier to get dealt a weak hand than a strong hand. So if your opponents are folding too much to your bets, take advantage of that all those times that you have weak hands. I mean, yeah, it's possible that if you happen to get a strong hand, then your opponent's tendency to overfold against you is going to work against you. But, you know, again, that just doesn't come up that much. I mean, really, the last thing that you want to do is let your opponents know what you know about their exploitability. Right? You don't want to tell them, hey, buddy, here's the thing you're doing wrong. Here's how someone could take advantage of you, because that would cause them to fix that leak and then deny you the opportunity to profit at their expense. So if you think that they're not calling often enough, then you should just, you know, keep quiet about it and bluff them more. So that kind of brings us to the end of the material that I wanted to cover here. I think it's possible that folks are going to have questions after listening to this. And, well, this would be a great opportunity for you to donate $5 to the Bay Area Urban Debate League and get that question answered. So once again, you can do that by going to thinkingpoker.net and looking in the show notes for any of the recent podcast episodes, anything that's published before, anything that's published in the month of December, let's put it that way. Anything that's published in the month of December, including this episode, there's going to be a link in the show notes. It's kind of a complicated URL. I think it's going to be easier for you to just click the link than for me to try to read it to you out loud. So go to thinkingpoker.net and you can find the link in the show notes, or you can go onto Twitter. If you are having trouble with all those things, you want to just email me, andrew@thinkingpoker.net. Email me and say, hey, Andrew, I wanted to make a donation, but for whatever reason, I'm having trouble finding the link. I'll send you the link. Email is also a perfectly fine way to get your question to me. You can also, I guess those are your options. Is you can leave the question as a comment somewhere on the blog. You can email the question to me. You can send the question to me on Twitter. Just, let me know that you made the donation when you're sending the question, and you will get not only your question answered, you'll get podcast episodes, kind of custom-made, not ones that are going to go on the regular feed, just recordings of myself, possibly a guest like Nate or someone else, answering these questions. You'll get answers not just to your question, but to every single question that's asked. So hopefully you found this useful. I guess it's a little bit in my interest if you were left with a few lingering questions that you'd like to get answered. Thanks for listening.
Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you want.